This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Robert Smith in Washington, D.C., sitting in for Neil Conan. Any magician will tell you that magic requires hard work. To master a card trick takes practice and skill. And if you're going to throw knives at a beautiful woman, make sure you've got good aim. And of course, you need a trusting audience. Someone's got to let you saw him or her in half. That said, any magician worth his salt won't tell you everything. Secrecy is important. Magicians form a small community with a storied history that dates back to the 16th century at least. They specialize in illusions, sleight of hands, and supernatural feats. And although it's not as popular as it once was, before the modern technological magic of the internet and television and movies, magicians still command audiences on street corners and clubs and at Las Vegas casinos. We want to hear from magicians today, professionals and amateurs both, and here's what we want to know. What trick got you interested in magic? Who showed it to you? How long did it take you to master it? And what has it taught you about life? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us via magic from our bureau in New York is Adam Gopnik, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His article, The Real Work, Modern Magic and the Meaning of Life, is in this week's issue on Newsstands Now. Adam Gopnik, it's good to have you with us.
It's wonderful to be here.
So what got you interested in magic? Everyone has a story from their youth or otherwise about when they first were captivated by this.
Well, like everyone, when I was a little boy, I had a magic set and I could do three tricks and was proud of them. But I had sort of put all that behind me. I must be the most ham-handed manipulator of objects in the world. And a couple of summers ago, we were sort of stuck in New York for the summer, my whole family, and we started going to a wonderful magic show off 9th Avenue in a church theater called Monday Night Magic. And we all got drawn in again to the wonderful thing that magic is, stage magic is, because it's simultaneously a holdover, a vestige of the great days of live entertainment, and you feel yourself at a good magic show in touch with much older traditions of entertainment and of showmanship. And at the same time, it was startling to me because I realized that in sort of the abstract qualities of magic, there was something that was actually quite profoundly philosophical. Why are we amazed? What surprises us? What does our degree of surprise tell us about our own minds? And I began having a series of conversations with one of the producers of Monday Night Magic, Jamie Ian Swiss, who turned out to be, like me, an essayist, a writer, as well as a magician. And from those conversations and from the world that opened up to me at that moment, I began to put together a piece, an essay about the subject.
You know, I was going to make a joke about that's how a New Yorker writer enjoys a magic show, is by thinking about the meaning of life. But I realized that as you talk to these magicians, that's exactly what they're thinking about, too.
Well, that was one of the things that startled and delighted me, which is that I would not have known the degree of intellectual acumen, mindfulness that's already present in the magic tradition and in the magic world. It sort of has to be. It's built into it. What you're doing every day when you're a magician is doing psychological experiments on willing subjects. You know more. A magician knows more about what astonishes people, about what people's expectations are. Every magician will tell you that people will collaborate in their own illusions, that there are misdirections that seem achingly obvious at the moment that you do them that are opaque to other people. You know, there's a famous psychological experiment that involves getting people to watch a video. I don't know if you've ever seen it. You can find it on the internet where people are bouncing balls, and you're supposed to follow the track of the bouncing ball. And in the middle of this very dull video of people bouncing balls to each other, a gorilla walks across the center and pounds his chest and walks out. And no one, I mean no one, notices the gorilla because you're busy watching where the basketball goes. This thing, which is a delight of psychologists in the last 10 years, magicians have known for centuries.
You know, we were talking a little bit about the skill, and that's the first thing you notice is the skill of magicians. But you take it a step farther. You say that the magician is one of the few true artists left on Earth. What did you mean by that?
Well, in two senses. First, because magicians have a huge repository of craft, accumulated craft. I love the expression that's common to magicians, the real work, because that they mean something more than the method, something more than the way that you go about doing the trick, the thing you can read off the side of the box if you're beginning, or in someone's notes and lectures if you're more advanced. It means that in order to make the illusion work, whether it's a small close-up illusion or a big stage illusion, there's a kind of inherited understanding of narrative, of approach, of ways of doing it that you can only learn, in a sense, by doing and through the example of other magicians. And I think anybody who's serious about their craft knows what the real work is, and they know when you've got it, and they know how hard it is to learn it. And then in a second sense, one of the things that fascinated me is that in lots of ways, sort of the natural ecological space in the environment of entertainment for magic has, if not vanished, at least diminished in the past century. You know, once you can make a special effect happen in the movies, once a woman can disappear through a dissolve or through a jump cut, some of what a magician can do on stage is necessarily diminished. A lot of the early movie special effects, in fact, were invented by magicians. And yet, magic hasn't disappeared. Magic hasn't diminished. And it puts me very much in mind, for years, I was an art critic writing about art for The New Yorker. And that's very much the story of modern art as well. Photography in the movies dried up a lot of the natural ecology of the painter. Nobody needs a portrait anymore. Nobody needs you to paint their house. Nobody needs you to paint their children. And yet, instead of responding to that challenge simply by disappearing, modern artists have found ways, through the growth of their own community, through other kinds of intimate coterie art, to go on. And magicians, I discovered to my delight and to my fascination, had very much the same kind of history, and kind of more and more internal history of great performers and great techniques, but instead of being big and blowsy and outward necessarily, a lot of it had the quality of chamber music or of the Absolutely. Art of Marcel yeah. Duchamp, something inward and intimate.
We're talking about magic and the philosophy of magic and what magic means to you. And, of course, we want to hear about your first trick. The phone number is 800-989-8255, talk@npr.org. Adam Gopnik and I, two observers of the craft, could talk about it for hours, but we need a magician in here. We're joined by Jamie Ian Swiss, a magician who lives in New York City. He is also in our New York bureau. We'll make him magically appear next to Adam Gopnik. Jamie Ian Swiss, welcome to Talkin' Nation.
Poof, here I am.
You see, it works so well on the radio.
Exactly. But what do they say? Radio has to be believed to be seen?
It's something like
not
that.
Not unlike magic.
And I have to say, you really opened my eyes about something, because a lot of times when I've watched a magic show, I feel a little stupid afterwards, like I'm being tricked. And you, in this piece by Adam Gopnik, you talk about how that's not the way to look at it, that in fact you need intelligence to appreciate magic.
That's correct. Being fooled is not the same as being a fool, and magicians are very actively using the audience's intellect against you. You know, you can't really do magic for a preschool child who doesn't understand the difference between what reality is and what magic is. You have to understand what reality is before you can recognize the contrast between that and magic. And so without intellect, magic doesn't really exist. The simplest magic trick doesn't exist. And although it's very counterintuitive and difficult for people to grasp, any magician will tell you that the more intelligent an audience, in many ways, the easier they are to fool. And this is why, among other things, besides magic, scientists and academics often are duped by psychic fraud and things like that, because they don't believe that they could be fooled by a so-called simple trick. But magicians don't make our living just fooling stupid people.
Yeah, if somebody were to materialize in front of me, I would have to assume that either magic existed or I was having a brain aneurysm or something like that. You make the point that it's the figuring out. I have to know that it's a trick. I have to work it out in my own mind and sort of go to a lot of dead ends in the maze in order to truly have that sense of enjoyment where I can almost see how it's done, but not quite, or at least have a suspicion, right?
Right. I think that's correct. And, you know, people are quick to talk about the willing suspension of disbelief, Coleridge's famous term about poetry, but that's often applied to the theater. And magic, however, is quite different. My friend Teller of Penn and Teller likes to say that there is no willing suspension of disbelief in magic. Magic is more like a theatrical rape, in the sense that you force the spectator into having to believe the illusion in front of him. We're all accustomed to the experience in Peter Pan. We all see the wires when she's flying across the stage. It doesn't trouble us at all because we are willingly suspending our disbelief. But if you see the wires in the magician's program of levitating the woman in the air, passing a hoop over her, if you were to see some kind of wire or something like that, then the whole thing is down the chute.
I wanted to get a quick phone call before we take a quick break. David is calling us from Chicago, Illinois. Go ahead, David. You want to talk about your first magic trick?
For me, it was the Sneaky Pete magic set that was given to my brother, who was a year and a half older than I. He didn't do anything with it. And 45 years later, it is still the passion of my life. Like Di Vernon, I wasted the first 5 years. I didn't get into magic until I was 5 and a half.
What does the Sneaky Pete magic set do?
The Sneaky Pete magic set is revered by collectors as one of the finer magic sets, and it had the standard assortment of beginner's magic tricks that awoken in me the love of magic that I continue with today.
Well, thanks for your call, David. Adam Gopnik, do magicians look down on these little plastic sets that people get when they're 8 years old, or is that really the key to their profession?
I think every magician started out that way. Every magician that I've known, every magician I've had the chance to speak to, begins maybe not at 5, but certainly at 7 or at 10 or 11 when they walked into a magic store and bought a magic trick and learned to do it, when they got that first magic set. It's one of the things, I think, one of the things that the piece in the magazine is about the connection between a certain moment in a boy's life, being 10, 11, 12, being drawn to magic, and how that carries on. It's something Jamie and I debate and argue back and forth about. When I say that, you know, all magicians, in a sense, are forever 11, I don't mean that in a negative way at all. I think in a very positive way, the same way that all scientists in their heart are still 4 years old, amazed by the world and desperately trying to make theories for it, the way that all writers like myself are really at heart 8 or 9 years old, where you're sort of aware and indignant at the same time. You want everybody to know what you know. I think there's an element in a very productive way in which magicians are all 11 or 12 at heart and remain that way forever.
Coming up, we'll ask Jamie Ian Swiss to do a magic trick on the radio. Seriously, magicians, give us a call. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. No, I won't ask how the trick is done. You can also send us email. It's talk@npr.org. I'm Robert Smith. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Robert Smith in Washington, in for Neil Conan. We're talking about magicians this hour with Adam Gopnik. His article about contemporary magic appears in this week's edition of The New Yorker. And we're also joined by Jamie Ian Swiss, a magician who lives in New York City. And of course, we want to hear from you. What was the magic trick or performance or sleight of hand that blew your mind? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And I will note, it is not a scientific sample, but so far, all of our callers waiting to talk about their first magic trick are men.
Well, this is a deep thing. Jamie, actually, I think, has a theory about why boys and men are so drawn to magic, and women often are, but much less so.
What do you think, Jamie?
I will point out there have always been women in magic. It's important to understand that. There are professional women in working in magic today, and there's a long history of that. Famously, one of the most famous American magicians of the 19th century, Alexander Herman, who defined the look of the magician with the goatee and mustache, when he died, his wife Adelaide took the show out, continued touring with the full illusion show. So there have always been women in magic, but that said, they are a distinct minority. And of course, as in other areas of life, there are first and foremost cultural barriers. Sexism has kept women out of the magic kit in a way, because people buy magic kits for their boys and dolls for their girls. But those things are changing, as we know. And nevertheless, I do think that when all those barriers are eliminated, women will still be a minority. And my own theory is that it has something to do with the different ways that men and women use power. I saw a talk once by a corporate psychologist about different styles of leadership and management and difference and sex differences therein, and that men lead from the front by example, come and follow me, whereas women lead from the back, like the Mother Goose. Go ahead, you can do it, you can do it. And both these strategies are perfectly effective, but the difference is the approach to power. And the problem with magic is that magic uses power very explicitly. You cannot avoid the fact that you, as the magician, are exerting this power over the forces of the universe. And I think that's not a natural form for women to display power.
Adam Gopnik, in your article, you talk about how Jamie Ian Swiss can be controversial sometimes, and I think we see why. I want to go to some of our callers and ask and ye shall receive. We have a female magician on the line. Jerry is calling us from Chico, California. Hey, Jerry. Hey, Jerry, are you online?
Yes, I am.
So, hey, what do you think?
I'm not a magician. I was a magician's assistant.
Poor baby.
No, I loved it. It was absolutely wonderful.
So how many parts of you are there?
Well,
left.
I'm very short because I was sawed in half so many times.
but approaching zero, but never quite getting there.
Exactly. But I wanted you to know that my first love for magic started when I was a child, when my father took me to see Blackstone. And the electric light cabinet was what I really loved.
What is the
beautiful
electric
illusion?
What is this illusion?
The electric light cabinet. And what happened was a woman was put in this cabinet, and electric lights, they looked like
fluorescent bulbs.
Exactly, like fluorescent bulbs, and they went through the body. And I just thought that was absolutely amazing, and that's what I wanted to do. As a matter of fact, my magician bought some of Blackstone's things when Blackstone stopped doing magic shows, and I wanted that cabinet, but he wouldn't buy it. He said, no, it was too dangerous for me because I was too curious. And he said, I can imagine you electrifying yourself.
Too curious.
Yourself.
Jamie and Swiss, have magicians always adopted the latest technology?
Yes, magicians have often been at the forefront of technology. As Adam pointed out, magicians were really the first to use film commercially and discover special effects. And a man considered the father of modern stage conjuring, Robert Houdin, a French magician in the mid-19th century from whom Houdini eventually took his name. Robert Houdin was an early user of electricity to light candles on the stage. And during a wonderful suspension, sort of a levitation piece that he used to perform, he used ether to anesthetize his son on stage before levitating him. And this was a very new cutting-edge medical idea at the time. And actually, the scent of the ether would waft through the theater, and the audience would be able to detect that. So magicians in some ways have always been on the cutting edge. And yet at the same time, we've always been asked, will technology damage magic? And in the end, that's not really true, because there's something visceral and direct and real and immediate about the experience that that transcends whatever the limits of the effects we do are versus the spectacle we see in television or film. But we can't really touch television and film the way we can touch magic.
Thanks for your phone call, Jerry. Let's talk to Frank. Frank calls us from Eugene, Oregon.
Hello?
Hey, Frank, you're on the air?
Yeah, hi. I started with magic also when I was 10. So we had a summer landlord who rented bungalows upstate New York, and he was a professional magician. And he would do a few shows for us as part of the bungalow colony, and I ended up kind of glomming onto him as a groupie. And the first thing he taught me was how to back palm a single card. And after that, it was the French drop coin illusions. Basically, sleight of hand work, and I was hooked from then on.
Adam Gopnik, this sounds familiar. The glomming on seems to be the formal way in which magicians are made, right?
Yes, you mean through apprenticeship.
Yes, yeah, well, that's a formal way of putting it. I picture more them following around, hanging around until they're given scraps of the trick.
One of the nice things about spending time in the company of magicians is that they tend to be very open to the ancient, almost medieval practice of apprenticeship. Kids hang out with magicians if they have the right spirit and the right kind of desire. And they learn, because it's very much the sort of thing where the real work is something that you have to learn. Some magicians inevitably are kind of snobbish about, you know, kid magic. You know, I have a kind of go away kid, you bother me attitude. But the best ones, in my experience, welcome the, you know, that bright 12-year-old who's obsessed with doing the basics of sleight of hand, because they see themselves as they once were there, and they also understand that the continuity of the art form depends on bringing those kids in. So there's a lovely, as I say, almost kind of medieval guild sense of connection between masters and apprentices in the world of magic.
I had one comment also on the male propensity for magic. Mm-hmm. I really suspect that it's part of the pre-adolescent or adolescent, you know, hey, look at me syndrome, something to get you visible, to be able to strut your stuff. And in some respects, it reminds me of the bower bird. You know, wow, look at this great functionless bower that I made for you. And it's, you can be a geek, you can be a non-athlete, and even the jocks will be amazed at some sleight of hand with a standard deck of cards.
But why would that aspect or explanation not apply equally to women?
Good question. But they are definitely a minority, and I would rarely see any women at Tannen's Magic Shop in Manhattan, or the first shop I ever went to was Al Flosso's Magic down in the 30s on the West Side, and
a legendary center of magic.
Oh, it's like walking into an apothecary from the
yes, it was
18th century.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for your okay. phone call, Frank. We wanted to see if we could maybe try a little bit of audio magic, which fascinates me, Jamie in Swiss, because when I think about it, you would almost think that eyes, vision is a necessary part of any magic trick.
Well, that's not entirely true, because one of the branches of magic that I engage in professionally is what magicians refer to as mentalism, which is basically the branch of magic that specializes in the illusions of mind reading and other sort of psychic phenomena. And that is a sort of more explicit case that's true of all magic, which is that ultimately magic happens only in the spectator's mind anyway. Sitting here with Adam in the studio, I thought that one thing that might be useful on the radio is a bit of mystery in which the listening audience will see exactly what Adam will see in front of me here, because the props I'm going to use are completely invisible and imaginary. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Great. So, Adam, what I'm going to present you with here from my pocket, now in my hand, as you can clearly see, are three imaginary coins in my hand. Can you see them?
I see three imaginary coins. I see
nothing. And, of course, you already know, but for the purpose of the listeners at home and for Robert, I will identify them as a quarter and a nickel and a dime. No doubt you knew that already. And if you could reach out with your left hand and take one of them. And what did you take?
I took the quarter.
That's fine. I'll keep these. And if you would just flip that coin and catch it and sort of snap it onto your hand there.
Flipping the imaginary coin and catching
it.
Right.
And tell me, what did you get?
Heads.
Heads. Excellent. You took the quarter. You flipped it. It came up heads. I didn't handle it. You handled the imaginary coin. We didn't arrange anything in advance.
No,
but sitting
not.
Here on the counter between us is this envelope I've had here for quite some time, which is a prediction I wrote before the show. And if you would just remove the card and read aloud to everyone what
it
I wrote.
It says, swear to God, the quarter is heads.
The quarter is heads.
The quarter is heads.
You did not arrange this ahead of time.
Absolutely not. We didn't see. This is I am the most astonished person. It says the quarter is heads. That's beautiful.
You know I want to ask how it's done, but I will ask it in this way. Adam Gopnik, you're doing this article. You have this requirement as a journalist to look these people in the eye and say, how did you do it? Did you ask that question, and did they kick you out?
I did ask the question from time to time, though I quickly learned that exposure, as magicians refer to it, giving away a method, is verboten. There's complicated kinds of decorum and diplomacy about it. Some methods are so familiar and so old that they sort of been exposed long ago. But magicians will defend the method in that way. But the more important thing that I did learn was that the method is not the trick, to quote Jamie Ann Swiss. That is that even if you knew the method of every trick you saw, you wouldn't be able to reproduce it. And in fact, the tricks that I have learned through hanging around magicians for that time and being with kid magicians and so on, one of the things I've learned is that once you know the method, you're sort of almost on the verge of being enraged by the simplicity, something that absolutely astounded you, like this thing that Jamie just did for me, the quarter is heads, when you find out very often how it's done. Sometimes when you find out how it's done, it's an absolutely amazing act of mental discipline and memorization. You're just hair-raising acts of mental acuity. And one of the things that magicians show us is the things we think are impossible, mental things we think are impossible, often are possible. They're just difficult. But on other occasions, the trick, the method, is unbelievably dumb and obvious once you get it. And that's something else I think that magicians can teach us, which is that we are tend to be very unobservant. We tend to be unaware of just how simply we can be fooled. I know that's something that everybody who engages in the exposure of fake psychics points out, which is that very smart people sometimes will say he never touched the envelope. In fact, he touched the envelope three times, but you participated in the notion that he didn't.
We are listening to Adam Gopnik from The New Yorker and Jamie Ian Swiss, a magician living in New York City. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to our callers again. We finally have a female magician on the line, Nicole from Portland, Oregon. I feel like you have to give the response now.
Well, yeah, so I'm sort of your lone female magician, I guess, for the show. And I actually got my start watching the street performers in Boulder, Colorado, because my parents were college students and we had no money to do anything else. And was totally, totally fascinated by watching these guys because it was all, the up-close sleight of hand kind of stuff. And the person in my family who really kind of nurtured me was my aunt, another female. And she's a lot better than I am, actually.
So when you hear all these theories about what men need to prove and their manhood and the transition to this, what do you think about those theories?
No.
you just like the fact that they're fun tricks, is that right?
Well, I mean, it's just a fun trick, and I wonder if more women aren't part of it because women, I think, have a hard time. This is just a guess. Fooling people or being dishonest, you almost feel kind of bad about it.
If my own feeling about watching it is obviously it's in large part a cultural stereotype and like all cultural – not a stereotype, essentially a cultural trend, tradition, prejudice, and like all of such things is changing and will change. I do think that in our society, at least in our particular civilization, it's true that there's a lot of burden put on 11 and 12-year-old boys to perform, to woo people, to begin to be socially adept. Women are naturally socially adept in my experience in a way that boys are not. And so magic, like playing the guitar, for instance, is one of those things that gives you at least the illusion of being socially adept. Jamie and I have had an argument about this for the last couple of years because I always have the sense that the truth is you can't woo anybody with a trick because they'll be, if someone's paying attention to you, woman or man, it's about as interested in you as they're going to get, and that's what you work on. I was saying this to Jamie one night at a restaurant on the far Upper East Side, and he immediately proceeded to attract a crowd of extremely attractive women of all kinds by doing magic at our table just between the two of us. So I may be wrong about that.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Jamie Ian Smith, always willing to prove the opposite. Thanks for your phone call, Nicole. Let's go for one last short phone call from Brent. Brent joins us from Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Brent, what was your first trick?
I was 12 years old. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Go ahead.
I was 12 years old, and I saw the sponge ball routine, the Albert Goshman sponge balls in a shop in Colorado Springs. I'd seen magic in shows and on television before, but I think the experience of seeing it close up was much different. Having, sponge balls split apart and multiply in my hands, it really got me hooked, and I became an amateur, and I still do magic to this day, even though currently I'm an attorney, and I think some people might find that a little bit disconcerting that I'm involved in that kind of dishonesty outside of my practice.
Well, I think the bar accepts that. So.
At least as a magician, you're an honest liar. First we promise to fool people, and then we do it.
That's true. I wondered if it's been your experience, what I've seen, especially from magicians like Penn and Teller and James Randi, that it seems like people that understand magic are generally a little bit more skeptical about things like, claims of psychics or claims about religion or even claims in politics. And I wonder if it's your experience that magicians, because of the way they learn about trickery and psychology and whatnot, do you believe that sort of engenders a little bit more natural skepticism.
And Jamie, we have about a minute. So.
I would say it's often true, but not always. Importantly, there is a longstanding history, a connection between magicians and critical thinking going back centuries. And, of course, very visible with Harry Houdini debunking the seance mediums of the 19th century and James Randi debunking psychics today. So there is a longstanding connection between the two, although I wouldn't say that all magicians are innately skeptical either.
Thank you very much for your call, Brent. Adam Gopnik is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. You can find his newest piece in the March 17th issue. Jamie Ian Smith is a magician who lives in New York City. You can read more about him in Adam Gopnik's article. He joined us also from the New York Bureau. Thank you both very much for being here and for the trip.
Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure.
Coming up, a new study estimates that 1 in 4 American adolescent girls are infected with a sexually transmitted infection. We'll take your questions next. I'm Robert Smith. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.